This morning, Genesis chapter 12 is where I'm starting. Genesis chapter 12. And that's where we're going to be here to begin this morning. While you're settling in, I'll tell you how thankful I am to be able to worship God with you today. It's good to be a family and be a congregation of God's people gathered. It's good to remind each other of the things that really matter. It's good to anticipate eternity by practicing what we're going to be doing someday, Lord willing, before His throne when we see His face by the grace of God through Jesus Christ. Glad that you're here this morning. Good to be with you. To our visitors, you're an encouragement and a gift to us. We don't take you for granted. We know that you have other things you could be doing, other places you could be, but you're here, and we're thankful for that. And we do hope that this is your first time, it won't be your last time, that you will get a visitor's card and fill that out before you leave, or just talk to one of the elders at the door on the way out. Let us know who you are, what brought you our way, what kind of spiritual needs are on your mind, and we'd be happy to talk with you or follow up with you and try to do what we can to be a blessing to you, as you are to us this morning. Glad that you are here. Well, I talk about Abraham from time to time. Abraham is one of my favorite people in all the Bible. I like Abraham. Abraham, of course, is liked by God. The Bible makes a big deal about Abraham. It's fascinating. He was called the friend of God by James in his little book. The friend of God. Even Moses only comes off as servant. But Abraham is friend of God. Just something different, something special about Abraham. And of course, the Bible holds out Abraham as not just a friend of God, something a kind of a unique life, well lived. But the Bible holds out Abraham's life as really an exemplar for us as well. In Romans chapter 4, Paul speaks of Abraham as the father of us all. Those of us who follow God in faith are, in a sense, children of Abraham, spiritually speaking. He is an exemplar. He is a prototype, a model of the kind of life that God likes and God looks for. And so in one sense, setting aside Jesus, of course, Abraham is, in one sense, the overarching, prototypical, ideal human in the Bible. He exemplifies what God is looking for in a human being. This is my kind of guy, God says. If more people would be like him, they could be my children, my friends as well. He is the model righteous person in God's scheme of redemption. Something that he transcends the testaments. He transcends all of the covenants. He is God's model righteous man. And so God picks him, and God determines to make a great nation out of him, and through him to change the world with one of his descendants in particular, Jesus of Nazareth, because Jesus comes through Abraham. Jesus, in one sense, is part of Abraham's reward for faithfulness, that God will save the world, including Abraham, through the one who descends from him, because Abraham is God's man. Abraham, of course, sits in an important place in the book of Genesis. You're, I think, familiar, many of you, with the basic plot line of Genesis up to chapter 12 and Genesis 1 and 2. God makes everything great and wonderful and perfect. It's very good. God says, I made this thing, and it's great. Genesis 3 and 4 are the stories of how Adam and Eve and the first human beings like Cain and Abel after them made a horrible mess of things. We let sin and death loose, and they have been wreaking havoc upon us ever since. We enslaved ourselves to sin, and every human being who reaches an age of moral accountability since then has joined in the rebellion of Adam. And so Genesis 3 and 4 tell the story of how what God made good got messed up. And it kept on getting worse and worse until you get to Genesis chapter 6 or so, and God decides to destroy the world because the thoughts of mankind's heart are continually evil. And so he saves 8 people, Noah, his wife, his sons and their wives. His 3 sons and their wives. It got so messed up that God decides to start over in Genesis 6 up through about Genesis chapter 9. And so God starts over. He starts the human race over with Noah. In Genesis chapter 9, Noah comes back out of the ark, and God starts over, makes a new covenant with Noah to be fruitful and multiply. Starts over. He's the new Adam. Before long, Noah and his sons have fallen into sin themselves. And so by the time you get to Genesis chapter 11, it's that story we call the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel, where again, the entire human race is gathered in collective rebellion against God. But this time, it's the same old song, but there's going to be a different verse this time. Instead of flooding the world in response to collective human rebellion, God this time hits the pause button for a minute and calls Abraham. This time, rather than destruction, God's answer to collective human rebellion is to call one man out of it all. To call Abraham. All of humanity is involved in the flood and the rebellion that leads to it. All of humanity is involved in the rebellion at Babel. God calls Abraham out. And so we have the story of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Have your Bible this morning. Read with me just a little bit. God said to Abraham, verse 1, or Abram at that point, excuse me, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land that I will give you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you, I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And so Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. He took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, all their possessions which they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan. And thus they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the mount of Moreh. And now the Canaanite was then still dwelling or settled in the land. And so you're familiar with the story, I think, from here on out. Abram will sojourn in the land for the rest of his life. He will always dwell in a tent. He'll even have to buy land. The only land he ever actually owned in the land that God promised him was land that he bought as a burial plot for Sarah when she finally passed away. And you remember the story of Abram. He's promised his son. Decades go by. He and Sarah, despite their age, have not had a son. They're so old it's hopeless. And so they try on their own to figure things out. Sarah offers her handmaid Hagar to Abram, and that produces Ishmael. And God says, no, Ishmael will not be your son of promise, Abram. I'm going to bring a son forth from you and Sarah. It's going to happen. And eventually that happens. Sarah, by the grace of God, has Isaac. And then God does the craziest thing in Genesis chapter 22. He tells Abram to take his son of promise, his only son whom he loves, and go sacrifice him. Go put everything that you've hoped for, go put the son you love, and the very key to all that I promised you, and go put him to death, just because I said so. And Abram doesn't flinch, he doesn't waver, he goes and he offers his son. Not literally, God stays the hand at the last possible moment, but in that last moment staying of the hand, God says to Abram, now I know. And now you know too, in a sense, that you are a man of faith who does what I ask simply because I ask. It's a great story, a tremendous man of faith who lives before God sacrificially and selflessly for decades on end and dies in hope, not having yet received the vast bulk of what God has promised to do for him. But for all that's great about Abram, it's interesting. Here's the thing. Even though Abraham is one of the great examples of the Bible holds him up as one of the great exemplars of human life and what human life is supposed to be. Even though he is willing to trust in God completely so much and do so much, he leaves his home, he leaves his family. He leaves his culture. He travels to the far side of the world as it was. He lives a vulnerable life of self-denial in a tent. Even though he's willing to trust in God and do all this, even though, by the way, we forget this part of the story sometimes, but God really doesn't have much of a track record yet in the Bible, you know? If Abraham wanted to go back and read stories of God's greatness in the Bible, what's he going to do? He's going to read about a flood where God destroyed people and he made the world good. But God hasn't done a whole lot yet, in a sense, with the human race. There's not a Bible with a whole bunch of chapters and stories you can go back and read and get faith and get hope. It's a short story so far. God hasn't really revealed himself vividly to the human race yet. He's going to start that with Abram, in fact. Abraham is Social Security number 000000001. He's the ground floor of this thing. He's willing to trust in God, even though God really doesn't have much of a track record to speak of yet. It's not yet a historical religion. It's not a, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's just now becoming the God of Abraham in the first place. The great call for the rest of the Bible, I am that God, that doesn't exist yet. There's been no resurrection yet. Nobody's ever been raised from the dead yet. And he comes to Abraham. Abram at that point. Leave everything behind for who knows what. Just go. I'll tell you when you get there. He's willing to sacrifice Isaac. Make the leap of faith about resurrection, how he will get his son back from the dead. But he's still human at the end of the day, and he's still capable of making bad decisions in the midst of a great life of faith. He's still human. Even during this period of life, he still fails. And so if you have your Bible still in Genesis chapter 12, from the greatness of the departure comes the reality of what it is to live a faithful life before God over the long haul. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 10, notice how it begins. Now there was a famine in the land. So Abram goes halfway across the world as it was in those days, and he winds up stuck in a famine in that part of the world. So much for blessing, so much for faith making everything better, faith making everything easy, faith making everything convenient. There is a famine in the land, and that affects Abram as much as affects the locals. There was a famine in the land. See, faith, ladies and gentlemen, faith does not exempt us from the problems of life in the fallen world. Even Abram has a famine. And so there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you." And it came about when Abram came into Egypt, the Egyptians indeed saw that the woman was very beautiful. And so Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And therefore he treated Abram well for her sake, gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say, 'She's my sister,' so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away and with his wife and all that belonged to him. And so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. And Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. Where do you think he got a lot of that stuff? Worked out pretty well for Abram in Egypt in one sense. What's the father of faith lying for? I mean, here's Paul saying Abram's the father of us all, a model of faith. What's the father of faith lying for? Well, listen, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to read that story and understand what Abram's motive is. He's afraid. It's fear. Fear is the great counterfeit and enemy of faith. He's afraid. But why is a great man of faith afraid? The temptation to lie, the temptation to deceive, comes in many forms. But one of the most powerful forms is for self-preservation. It's kind of like the conversation between a prosecutor and a defendant. The prosecutor has the defendant up on the stand testifying in his own defense. And the prosecutor says, "Did you kill the victim?" And the defendant says, "No, I did not." And the prosecutor says to the defendant, "Do you know what the penalties for perjury are?" And the defendant says, "Yes, I do. And they're a lot less than murder." A half-truth is still a whole lie when it's intended to deceive or to mislead. And sometimes we lie or we deceive for greed, for self-advancement. Sometimes we just lie or we deceive because we're afraid. We want to preserve ourselves. And that's Abram. This is apparently a pattern with Abram. Because isn't it interesting, if you turn the pages of your Bible, if you've forgotten this story, turn to chapter 20 still in Genesis. And again, the years and the decades have gone by this point in the story. Decades, I say, have gone by. And chapter 20, verse 1, "And Abram journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. And there he sojourned in Gerar. And Abram said to Sarah, his wife," I've heard this conversation before, "'She is my sister.' And so Abimelech, king of Gerar, did what kings do. He sent and he took Sarah. But God this time came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, 'Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken,'" because she's married. "And Abimelech had not yet fortunately come near her. And he said, 'Lord, Lord, will you slay a nation even though blameless? Did not he himself say to me, "She is my sister"? And she herself said," now notice, I want you to notice something, because we're going to make something of this in a minute. I want you to notice that Abram's habit has spread now. In chapter 12, it was just Abram. But now who's participating in this little project this time, according to Abimelech? Well, now Sarah joins in, at least as far as the text tells the story. Sarah joins in. "Did not she herself say, 'Yep, he's my brother'? And so in the integrity of my heart," Abimelech says to God in the middle of the night, "and the innocence of my hands, I thought she was single." And so God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this. And I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you will surely die in all who are yours." And so Abimelech arose early in the morning. I wonder if he even went back to sleep that night. What would you have done? Early in the morning is about 5 a.m., I think. "Abimelech arose early in the morning, called all his servants, told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened, and rightly so. And the Midbar called Abram and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you brought on me and my kingdom a great sin?" What did I do wrong to you? I never sinned against you. What in the world did you put me in this position for? And Abimelech goes on, second half of verse 9. "You have done to me things," and this is the powerful point, "things that ought not be done." This is not how people treat each other, man. And Abimelech goes on and says to Abram, verse 10, "What have you encountered that you've done this thing? What made you so afraid of life and think so poorly of people? When did you become such a cynic?" And Abram said, "Because I thought surely there's no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife." Ah, technicalities. Anybody who's a teenager has had that conversation. "And it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, 'This is the kindness that you will show to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.'" I love that line too. How would you have that conversation with your wife in the car when you're going somewhere? "Everywhere we go, honey, you're my sister." No one's ever said to Amanda, "That looks like your brother." Now, awkwardly, people thought my mom was my sister. She was thrilled. I'm still not sure what to make of that. She looks a lot younger and I look a lot, well, no. And so Abimelech, verse 14, "took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. And Abimelech said, 'Behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please.' And to Sarah he said, 'Behold, I've given your brother.'" Notice what he says, the kind of zinger, by the way, in verse 16. "To your brother I've given 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, this is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men. You are clear." In other words, I'm giving you a big check to prove I did not touch you. It's come, you know, he said, she said now. To prove I didn't do it. But your brother, not your husband. Yeah, I'll play the game too then. But put them in their place. Now here's the thing. You read these stories like this, and in one sense, everything seems to work out okay. In both stories, Abraham gets rich, and then he gets richer. It seems to work out well. And God always bails Abram out in the end with plagues on Egypt and with a dream to Abimelech. Everything works out okay. Abram gets his wife back. He gets some riches to boot. And he's still allowed to go wherever he wants and settle wherever he will. But that's only the surface level reading of the story. That everything seems to work out okay. Because what he gained in deeds and in dollars may well have hurt him as well. Because, for instance, and back in Genesis chapter 12, one of the things that we learn that Abram picks up in Egypt is this maidservant Hagar. Yeah, now she'll factor probably in the story. She'll be the one whom Abram will use as a concubine. That will lead to Ishmael. Ishmael will lead to nations that will be the enemies of the Jews for centuries to come. So the irony is, Abram in his Egyptian sojourn has actually just shot himself in the foot. Because the offspring of the Egyptian handmaid he picks up there will be the enemies of his own children in the years that come. And eventually, in one sense, Abram and Lot get to be so rich that they can't get along at all. Their herdsmen, at least, can't get along at all. There's not enough room for all their animals and all their wealth together. And so in Genesis 13, Lot goes towards Sodom. And you know about all the mess that comes from Lot pitching his tent towards Sodom. I mean, let me ask you something, ladies and gentlemen. Has this ever happened to you? Has it ever happened to you that you do something you shouldn't have done? Everything works out. You seem to have dodged a bullet. No real consequences. You got away with it, or at least even if you got caught, there were no real consequences. Everything seems to have worked out. No apparent meaningful long-term consequences. And so you think God must have winked at it or not noticed it, or really maybe your sins don't really find you out after all. There are two takeaways I want us to have in the time that we have together this morning. Two takeaways. Number one, I want to highlight the issue of lying and deceit itself. I'll come back to that at the end. But what I want you to also know is the second takeaway that I'm going to tackle first this morning is this. That even though lying is absolutely pervasive in our culture, older people do it, younger people do it. And so many people have come to the point that they do it habitually and reflexively. The other point is this. That sin spreads. And it often spreads within families, and it spreads from generation to generation. What happened was that while it seems on one level, on the surface reading of the story, that everything worked out fine for Abraham, the truth of the matter is he started a precedent that spread in his family. In chapter 12, it's him. In chapter 20, it's Abimelech saying, "Sarah said this too." But you keep the story going. And what happened was that Abraham literally started a legacy that became a generation by generation sin in his family that kept bigger and bigger, and the audience kept getting larger and larger. Here you have Abram, and Abram tells a half-truth to a stranger. True words with Abraham. I tell you true words, though, that I know will cause you to think something that is wrong. True words, a half-truth to a stranger that was calculated to deceive. But then what comes is you come along and you have Isaac in Genesis chapter 26. Isaac in Genesis chapter 26. And once again, Genesis 26, Isaac is afraid of the men of the place where he is at, that they will look at his beautiful wife. And so he says, chapter 26 and verse 7, when the men of the place asked about his wife, Isaac said, "She is my sister." Now, where do you think Isaac learned to do that? Family stories on a dinner table growing up. Hey, Abram, tell the story again about that time you got out of it with the king of Gerar. That's a great story. Tell us a story about the time you got away with it. So here's Isaac. She is my sister, because I'm afraid the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah. Not only has he learned to lie, he's also learned to be afraid. He's inherited both the flaw in Abraham's faith and the response to it. And so sure enough, again, this time Rebekah's not taken, but it happens that the rumor goes around, she's just a sister. Abimelech, very awkwardly in verse 9, looks out the window, verse 8 of Genesis 26, looks out the window and saw Isaac caressing Rebekah. And then Abimelech calls Isaac and says, "What's going on? She really is your wife, man. Come on. How then did you say she's my sister?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I thought I might die on account of her," which Rebekah thought was romantic, but Isaac wanted no part of. "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." And so Abimelech had to charge the people, saying, "Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." So the real moral of the patriarchal story is marry ugly women. No, that's not the moral of the story. But I want you to notice that that doesn't stay with Abram. The flaw in his faith and the response to it spreads. But now, unlike Abram, who tells a half-truth to a stranger calculated to deceive, Isaac tells a full lie to a stranger calculated to deceive. But at least in Abraham's story and in Isaac's story, at least they were trying, it was self-preservation, something that we can relate to. They weren't trying to do it for advantage or for gain. But then you turn the page to Genesis chapter 27. And in Genesis 27, now Isaac has his own sons, Esau and Jacob. And Jacob, at his mother's behest, goes to steal Esau's blessing. And so in Genesis 27, having put on Esau's clothes, having put animal skin on his arm so that he's hairy like Esau, he comes in to take advantage of his father's blind eyes, failing sight. His father says to him, Genesis 27, verse 19, he comes to his father and says, "My father." And he said, "Here am I. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob says to his father, notice that, Jacob says to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn, and I have done as you have told me. And so get up, please, sit and eat of my game that you may bless me." And Isaac said to his son, "How is it you so quickly basically caught this game?" Because remember, Esau was supposed to go out and hunt it. So Jacob's now going to keep extending the deception. And so he says, second half of verse 20, "Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me." And then Isaac says to Jacob, "Please come close that I may feel you." Something not right with this story. You ever have that experience with your kids' parents? "Let me see your cell phone. Let's test this." Isaac calls Jacob closer. "Please come close that I may feel you, my son, whether you're really my son Esau or not." And so Jacob came close to Esau, and his father felt him. He says, "The voice is the voice of Jacob," because young people catch this. Your deceptions are never as good as you think they are. Your parents aren't that stupid. "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize it because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands." And so he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" Again, third or fourth time here now, and Jacob doubles down. "I am." And so he gets the blessing. And so a little bit later, when Esau, the real Esau, comes in and offers his father his food, that Isaac and Esau realize what's happened. But here's the thing. Now we've gone past a half-truth to a stranger to save your life, or a whole lie to a stranger, but at least you're trying to save your life, not profit off it, to now you're telling a whole lie, not to a stranger, but to your father, complete with an elaborate deception, repeated doubling down on the lie for personal advantage, to take what is not yours. But the spread of the sin of lying and deception doesn't stop there in the family of the patriarchs. You turn a couple more pages to Genesis chapter 37. Picking up in verse 31, so they took Joseph's tunic. Who's the they? The brothers. Remember, they sell Joseph because they hate him so much. They sell him into slavery. He's taken away in a caravan to Egypt. They still have Joseph's tunic, the mark of his father's love and preference for him. And so they took Joseph's tunic, and they slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in blood, and they sent a varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it. See whether it is your son's tunic or not." And he examined it, and he said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast must have devoured him. Joseph surely has been torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." And so Jacob wept for Joseph. Now we get to a point in the patriarchal family where we're not talking about lying or deception to save a life, like Abraham and Isaac were, nor to even get what they thought they deserved or what they really wanted, like Jacob did. Now we have lying and deception simply because we hate one of our own. This is murder in effigy. In one sense, they could rationalize it. All we've done is just kind of shown Jacob a torn and bloody coat. Let him draw his own conclusions. We said nothing. All the rationalization of deception. We didn't tell him that Joseph was killed or torn to pieces. He said that. All we did was say, "Here's a bloody coat. What do you think?" They knew what they were doing. They set him up to believe that. Lying and deception all the way through because they hated their brother. And rather than actually just killing him outright, decided to profit off of his death, so to speak, by selling him into a slavery that, of all things being equal, had God not been with Joseph, likely been a short life in servitude. And so I want us to walk away this morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I want us to understand something. I want us to understand something well as we catch back up here. And it's this. That even the big shots of the Bible, even the great people of God, even in their lives, the rules and principles of human sin and human suffering do not change. Little things matter. And even one-time sins are what we would consider to be small personal failings can have consequences long-term out of all proportion to our perception of them. It was a seemingly small flaw in an otherwise great man of faith, Abraham. But it was a flaw that became a family legacy. Lying and deception run through the patriarchal family through and through, spreading and getting worse with each passing generation. So much for the modern idea of, you know, my sin is just really between me and God. It's really hurting nobody but me and God. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to understand that, especially those of us who are parents with children in our homes, what we do and who we are affects others. Sin makes ripples throughout lives, just like a rock thrown on a pond. You know, we've been through a difficult time here since Friday, in our local area in particular, with yet another school shooting. It's interesting, you know, the tragedy of that always leads to questions of why. Could we have prevented this? Could we have seen this coming? What did we miss? Was this a particularly troubled young man, or what was going on? And it's interesting. Some of you know the name Malcolm Gladwell. He's a writer, who's written several books, writes for The New Yorker. He wrote what was actually a very terrifying piece in The New Yorker several years ago about the nature of school shootings. He based it on the work of a Stanford sociologist named Mark Granovetter. And Granovetter's basic work, it was actually a paper that Granovetter wrote back in the 70s, but Gladwell had the insight to apply his sociological insights to the nature of why certain acts of evil happen in societies. And grandmother thought particularly in terms of riots, how a riot develops, how one or two people do something, then others join, and then you have a riot in a city or in a town or in a downtown or something. And the article says this. It says, a riot is a social process in which people did things in reaction to and in combination with those around them. Social processes are driven by our threshold, which Granovetter defined as the number of people who need to do some activity before I will agree to join in. In other words, I won't be the first person to throw a rock through the window. But maybe I'm the type of person, if someone else does it first, I'll do it with them. Maybe I'm not the type of person who will be the first one to throw a rock through the window or the second person to throw a rock. But if five other people have already done it, now I'll join in. And so the idea was, that's how riots develop in a sense. Usually all you need is a low threshold person. Somebody doesn't take much to push them over the edge. They throw the rock, then a couple other folks who aren't that far gone but don't need much pushing will join in. And then by the time it's all over, you got people looting stores who would never have stolen a thing in their life, but everybody else is doing it all of a sudden. And Gladwell's point is that as it applies to even something as difficult and hard and troublesome in our time as school shootings is this. That each successive shooting lowers the threshold for the next one. That rather than seeing a riot as a singular one-time event, that see this as a kind of a slow-motion riot through 20, 30, 40 years in our country. And so in a sense, what happened in 1998 at Columbine becomes the script for the troubled young person who maybe would never have thought of that on their own, but now they've seen someone else do it and how to do it. Might be willing to copy it themselves. They're not the first one to throw the rock, but as each time another person throws a rock, they're ready to join in. That's a sociological way of looking at the spread of sin in a society, folks. And that's what you and I need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that when we sin, it's not just a matter of what happens between me and God. When I sin, I tear the social fabric. I make it easier for someone else to do that sin later. Because there are always those who would not do it themselves unless someone else has done it first, in one sense, shown them how. Seeing others do something always lowers the threshold, whether it's something tragic and sociological like a school shooting, or whether it's sin and lying in a family. The essence of the spread of sin is that each sin lowers the threshold for others for the next one. And so Gladwell finishes his article on school shootings with this depressive paragraph. He says, in the day of Eric Harris, who was one of the Columbine shooters, we could try to console ourselves with the thought that there was nothing we could do, that no law or intervention or restriction on guns could make a difference in the face of someone so evil like Eric Harris. But the riot has now engulfed boys who were once content to play with chemistry sets in the basement. The problem is not that there is an endless supply of deeply disturbed young men who are willing to contemplate horrific acts. It's worse than that. Is that there are young men who no longer need to be deeply disturbed to contemplate horrific acts. Because the standard gets lower, the standard gets lower, the standard gets lower. And as the people of God, ladies and gentlemen, we need to understand that that's not just a sociological issue for us to sort out what we're going to do as a country. That's an issue of sin and right and wrong and how it spreads through people and families and over time. When I sin, no matter how small I may see it, I've lowered the threshold for somebody who's watching me. Maybe that's my own children. Maybe that's a young person in the congregation. Maybe that's a brother or sister in Christ who's of age and should know better and maybe would never have done it on their own, but since I do it and they respect me, now they'll do it too. And so Abraham's issue reminds us of the corrupting power of sin to spread over time, to spread between people, especially in families. But then I said this morning, I want to come back to the issue of lying and deception itself. Abram's story, that was Abram's great weakness, and it spread like cancer through his family over the years. Let me make three quick observations in the last couple of minutes I have with you this morning about what it means to deal with deception and deal with lying. Because again, that is something that has spread through our culture like a cancer. Everybody lies, it seems. Everybody's willing to deceive at a certain point for a certain reason. And one of the things that I have noticed over the years is that that's cancer of the culture has gotten into other people of God as well. Many young people struggle with telling the truth always under any circumstance. Not deceiving your parents when they're not looking. Maybe you wouldn't lie outright, but you will deceive. And certainly those of us who are adults, we know that we have our pressure points. We have those moments when we want to fudge the numbers. We want to say something different or other. Let me leave you with three quick observations this morning about what it means to deal with deception. Number one, let's understand that a half-truth intended to mislead is still a whole lie. Whether it's Abram saying she technically is my sister, yes, I wanted you to think she wasn't my wife, but she really is technically my sister, that's still, the intent was to lie. He might as well have told an outright lie because the effect was the same. Down to the same end, when Joseph's brothers could technically say, well, we never said Joseph was dead. No, they set Jacob up to believe that with what they did with the coat, with the blood, and so forth. A half-truth intended to mislead is a whole lie. Are you listening, young people, this morning? A half-truth intended to mislead is a whole lie. There are all kinds of situations in life where we are tempted to use true words that we know the other person will understand differently and will be misunderstood, perhaps even to our advantage. But the point is, we know we're not going to be heard correctly, but we'll walk away and say, you know, I spoke the truth. When it comes to honesty, we cannot hide behind technicalities. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, let your yes and no be what they are. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil, Jesus says. Do you hear him this morning? Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And James picks up on that. James chapter 5, but above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any oath, but let your yes be yes or your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Now listen, I think what James is saying there is not literally that I can't take an oath if I'm in court. Do you swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? He doesn't literally mean that no oaths. What he's saying is live a life that is so honest and above reproach and beyond deception that nobody needs you to take an oath to believe you in the first place. I understand why in the court of law they may want me to do that because I'm a stranger to them. But nobody in my life, nobody who knows me, should ever have to wonder about what I say and whether they can trust it. Nobody can ever wonder if Jeff is pulling his leg or trying to pull a fast one because, yeah, Jeff says what's true or what's technically accurate, but Jeff's always got another side to the angle of what he's saying. There's always another side to the story. There's always another piece of the puzzle. Something missing. Jeff always holds back the full truth. You need to remember that a half-truth intended to mislead is absolutely a whole lie. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't be tactful. It doesn't mean that we can't be encouraging. Next time somebody asks you, what do you think of their new grandbaby? You don't have to say, wow, that baby sure is ugly. Well, I told the truth. The wise man understands in the book of Proverbs, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Part of wisdom is knowing how to speak the truth and do others good. Not to deceive them, to mislead them, or to give me advantage over them. That's part of wisdom. But too often it's far easier to be wise and evil. We're much more skilled at deceiving through saying what's technically so than encouraging through what's truly honest. Number two, when it comes to dealing with deception, this story of Abram leaves us thinking and wondering. We need to understand that our personal integrity really is priceless. Our personal integrity really is priceless. If you have to be dishonest for financial, business, or work reasons, if you have to be dishonest for your business to succeed, you have to be dishonest to keep your job, you need to walk away. And you need to be prepared to walk away. Listen to what, again, the wise man says in Proverbs 19 and verse 22. Proverbs 19 and verse 22, the text says this. What is desirable in a man is kindness, and it is better to be a poor man than a liar. It's a certain amount of faith, I think, to accept that, doesn't it? But we are people of faith. We are meant to be children of Abraham in the best sense. It's better to be a poor man than to be a liar. Do you have faith to believe that this morning? Do you have faith to live that way this morning? That no lie, no deception, no subterfuge is worth your personal integrity. Because at the end of the day, you want to live like Abraham lived in the best sense. You want to live dependent upon God. If God's provision doesn't satisfy you, you're not going to lie and deceive your way into what you really want. You're going to acknowledge the fact that you're just covetous. And you learn to be content with such as the Lord has provided in your life. You will not cheat, steal, lie, deceive to get your way. Because you have enough faith to understand it's better to be poor than to be a liar. And thirdly and finally this morning, again, let me drive this home. Your attitude towards truth affects children, your children. Again, I can't say this strongly enough. Over the years, I've seen enough that I'm very concerned about how common lying and deception have become, even among God's people. We don't do it to each other, but we struggle with this in life. Those of us who are parents need to understand that our children know who we are and what we are doing. And this general intergenerational principle we saw in the patriarchal family this morning applies to us as well. Here's the hard truth, parents. Our children will take what they learn from watching us, and they will go a little bit further than we did. That's the story of the patriarchs, right? Each generation goes a little bit further with it than the last one. Not only does it spread a little bit further each generation, but it gets a little bit worse. It gets a little bit darker. It gets a little bit sinister. It gets a little bit more destructive. Understand that whatever small sin as you conceive of it that you are tolerating in your life, your children know it, and your children will go further with it than you ever would. Because that's the principle of the spread of sin. That's the principle of the riot, like in sociology. First to throw the stone, but if you throw the stone for them, they'll be the one to join in and go further and do more and do worse. Based on your example, they will not learn to restrain themselves. They will not learn to resist temptation. And so every time that we tell our children to answer the phone and say, we're not here, and then we're shocked, we're just absolutely shocked when they tell us, yes, they've done their homework. No, I wasn't over at so-and-so's house. And we find out later they've been lying to us. Well, where did they learn that? They see us take cash for a job instead of invoicing a client. And then we're blindsided. We're just flabbergasted when they get caught cheating on a test. Yet they know how we do business. And like father, like son. We sit in services week by week. We go through the motions, but in the week, we live with no positive effort at being an active, obvious Christian, salt and light to the world the rest of the week. And then we're shocked. We're just shocked when our children won't even go to church anymore when they're older. Our children will take whatever we are and go one step deeper, one step further. Kids do indeed learn what they observe. But their boundaries and their applications get a little bit wider each and every time, just like Abraham's family. And what started as a relatively small matter becomes a gaping breach in the life of faith over the generations of the patriarchs. God help us to protect our own families, our own children, to never be the one who is the weak link, the one who weakens the cause of truth, the cause of right, the one who weakens the faith of the younger, the children whom Jesus calls blessed when they come to him. God, help us to not be the one who makes it easier for those who come after us to do what they never would have done themselves. And in particular, maybe where we start applying that first and foremost today is with the lying and deception that maybe we're practicing in our own lives. If you're here this morning and you need to get your life right with God, we want to encourage you to do that before we leave this place. If you're here this morning and you're ready to enter into the kingdom of God, a completely different way of living, setting aside all lying and deception, all sorts of sexual immorality, whatever else the world calls good these days. You're ready to leave that behind. Become a child of God. We'll help you with that this morning. If you're ready to confess your faith in Jesus, Lord, Savior, Son of God, repenting of your sinful participation in the world, we'll baptize you for forgiveness of sins. You're here this morning and you're a child of God already. You're one of Abraham's children. But you're moving in the wrong direction. Abraham's family of decline rather than Abraham's spiritual family of improvement. Pray to God for forgiveness of every fail this morning. Whatever it is you need to set right again in your life, you need to quit, you need to repent of, you need to get forgiven of. We stand ready and willing and wanting to help you with that. Why don't you come talk to us while we stand? While we stand.
Most have been like them,